Hello and welcome to This Week in Oklahoma Politics. I'm your host, KOSU's Michael Cross, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Earlier this week, Oklahoma City Attorney Jerry Fent took his case against Senate Bill 1246, reducing Oklahoma's income tax from 5.25% to 5% to the state Supreme Court. Now, Ryan, does Fent have a case here?
Oh, I think he does. And given the grilling that the state solicitor took before the court, I think that the court is taking Fent's arguments and the arguments advanced in the amicus briefs incredibly serious. This is a novel case, but it's not a novelty case. And Justice Gurich said, why don't they just follow the Constitution? All this whole issue is about is follow the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma. Now, I got to tell you, I've got some real concern in that advice because it might just put me out of business if the legislature just starts following the Constitution to the letter of the law. But I think that the case law in both Oklahoma and federally was settled. Whenever the legislature puts State Question 640 on the ballot, they knew that there, or they should have known that there was this case law out there that said that raising revenue meant to collect revenue, didn't necessarily mean to increase taxes. So they knew this. They could have been more clear if they'd wanted to be. Ignorance isn't an excuse at this point.
Neva, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think Fent's point has always been that the subject written in the bill is an income tax and that it is a revenue bill. I do think it's interesting, and Ryan is right, the exchange with the Supreme Court this week was very interesting, and I think what we saw was some give and take. I mean, clearly Justice Taylor seemed mm-hmm. to be on one side, Justice Cogger seemed to be asking questions trending the other side. So we very well may have a split decision on this. They didn't act making determination yet, and I think it is a big question. And the governor's kind of laid down the gauntlet from her standpoint and said that she really hopes that that what will be upheld is the spirit of the Constitution and the will of the voters to be able to uphold tax cuts as constitutional. So there's a clear divide here, and it'll be interesting to see which side the court actually comes down on.
Well, let me ask you, there have been several tax cuts since 640 was passed. If the state Supreme Court says any revenue has to follow the letter of the law, what does this do to pass tax cuts?
Yeah, the court, I think, has a lot of latitude here. The remedy that the court lays down could be applied to this bill and all bills going forward.
Right.
And they wouldn't necessarily have to go retroactive for the last decade plus of tax bills that have been passed that could also have been unconstitutional, according to Fent's argument. One of the other takeaways here is that, boy, the Supreme Court ought to have more oral arguments. I think it's, very rarely do we see in our other two branches of government the kind of in-depth questioning and follow-up, the logical follow-up and the types of questions that we saw on display here. I mean, these are serious questions. There are serious answers by both sides. And I think it's a real testament to what our democracy could be if we had open, candid, and rational exchanges.
But certainly future bills, if you have to get a three-quarters vote or a vote of the people, that could change how things go for the future on tax cuts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Last week, the Department of Corrections announced it would be ready for executions in November. Soon afterward, the state said, not so fast. The Attorney General is asking for a delay for the next three death sentences. Neva, does the request for a delay surprise you?
No, not at all. And I think it really falls in line with what we've talked about for the last several weeks. And so when Attorney General Pruitt requested this execution date of January 15th as the first one, and then subsequent ones in the ensuing 2 months for the ones that are on hold, I think what it did was just to provide the opportunity to continue to kind of vet this process. The review went through on the part of the Department of Public Safety, but clearly there's litigation, still at hand with the suit that is. And Ryan, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was 26 inmates that are in this suit, mm-hmm. including the three right. in question that are up for execution. So I think I think it's one of these complicated situations where everyone has to make sure that it's fully vetted and we have enough time. And I think the Attorney General was very prudent in his approach to it this week.
What do you think about the delay?
Yeah, I think if the state hadn't asked for a delay, it was very likely that a federal court was going to put a stay in place anyways. The prospect of having and holding executions in November, you had multiple requests in federal courts, both in the litigation that we filed at the ACLU and the Observer v. Patton, where we're challenging the state's assertion that the media doesn't have an inherent First Amendment right to access and report objectively on executions. I think that there are multiple opportunities for federal courts to weigh in, so it just made sense for the state to ask for this stay. It's important to point out that time can't fix everything that's wrong in these new protocols. When we get to January, these protocols will still embody a contempt for the public and transparency, and will not make it any less likely that we're essentially experimenting on condemned inmates. So unless we see some changes in those protocols, either through a mandate by a federal court or by revisiting the protocols themselves by the state, time alone won't fix this.
Everybody is talking about Ebola in the news right now. So on Monday, Governor Fallon, along with health and public safety officials, got together to both calm anyone worried about an outbreak and reassure the state was ready for any situation. Ryan, was this handled correctly?
Yeah, I think it's important that we're ready. And we need to demonstrate that we're putting appropriate measures in place to calm any fears the fear that's emerging in the populace, not only in Oklahoma, but around the world. But we also need to add a measure of proportion to our response. There's a recent New Yorker article that points out that we're on the verge of flu season, and that as people begin to exhibit symptoms of the flu, that's going to increase the number of people who you may think and confuse those symptoms with symptoms of Ebola. So the paranoia and the rumor mills that are going right now are only going to get more intense as we move into flu season. I do think that it's worth pointing out that we've got thousands of Americans that will likely die of the flu this season, hundreds of thousands that are going to be hospitalized. Again, we need to put our fears in proportion. As a society, we're not very good at doing that. We often put a great deal of fear on things that don't pose, at least statistically, the greatest danger to us as individuals.
Neva?
Well, and I think all of this is complicated by the social media age that we live in, and mm-hmm. we have this rapid amount of information that's out there. Much of it is not accurate, and I think what the governor and her entire team of professionals were trying to demonstrate and convey to the public this week is that there have to be protocols in place, there has to be a plan, there has to be the dissemination of accurate information, which they made very clear would be on the Department of Health website, that the information would be distributed through all of the appropriate venues. And I think it did give a sense of calm and a sense of a relief to many that we were being proactive rather than waiting to be reactive to things that might happen in Texas or some other state.
With just a few weeks left till the general election, supporters of Republican Joy Hoffmeister for state superintendent are attacking her opponent's salary, saying Dr. John Cox shouldn't be making nearly $150,000 as a superintendent of PEGS. Neva, what are your thoughts on this attack?
Well, first of all, I mean, I even heard Dr. Cox himself say in a forum that he knew that the two things that he would be kind of attacked on or that would become central issues in his campaign would be his salary and the fact that he was a rural superintendent. And it's clear, I mean, we're in the closing stretch. It's a very competitive campaign. Mm-hmm. Both sides indicate that it is anyone's guess at this point who will come out on top. But I think to suggest that there's some surprise that rural superintendents make six figures is certainly bogus. And I think anyone in the legislature, I don't care if they're a Republican or a Democrat, this is not new information. First of all, it's on the website. It's clearly been out there for years. And it's always been known for anyone that followed education that rural superintendents, many, many of them actually are six-figure salaries. Now, when you look at it and you see even in Dr. Cox's case, how he explained why they, you know, why he comes up with that amount of money with the different jobs that he does and roles that he fulfills. I think that's the argument that many of those rural superintendents make. Right or wrong, we can go down the list and argue any one of them, but I think the bigger picture is it's about who is going to lead the state and the Department of Education, and this is where I think both the candidates really are going to rise or fall on making the sell to the Oklahoma voter on their qualifications more than their salary.
Ryan.
Yeah, I think that this is a classic case of misdirection. Yeah, you've got a couple of legislators trying to change the conversation from, you know, what teachers ought to be making to looking at what John Cox is making. And as Neva said, you know, he, like many rural superintendents, fulfills a number of jobs in that school district. I think that he's currently the principal. He's director of federal programs. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't drive a bus.
Yeah, you know, a lot of those rural superintendents.
I mean, they're out driving buses as well. So, you know, whether those salaries are justified, that's a conversation for the legislature to have. But I agree with Neva. It's not one that legislators are surprised about. And I also think that it's pretty rich that you got a couple of legislators that have been part of a legislative body that have gutted hundreds of millions from classrooms. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities is releasing a study, I think today, that shows that between 2008 and 2014, Oklahoma made the biggest per pupil cuts in the nation, 23.6. The next state is Alabama at 17.8%.
I think when we talk about salaries, too, one thing to remember is there are many of these districts that may have 100, 200, 300 students where you have a six-figure superintendent salary. But let's remember, it is about local control. And I mm-hmm. think any of these folks, I mean, if you really want to have a legitimate debate, bring it back home to the local control where the school board has made that contract with that individual. And they either fulfill what they see as the expectations of that person or not. So I think that kind of gets lost in the mix on whether or not that's a legitimate debate for the bigger picture of who's going to be state school superintendent.
I don't think people are remembering that he doesn't just give himself that
right.
money. It's actually accepted by the school board in PEGS.
Yeah.
That's right.
And Neva's absolutely right. Yeah, this is a matter that the local school board needs to set that policy because they got to retain somebody or recruit people in the future.
I think it points to the fact, and I've always advocated, that you know, one of the areas where there is the least amount of involvement, the least amount of voter participation are on school board elections
right.
where you have these folks making these salaries. You have the expectation of parents and patrons wanting a real good bang for the buck. And whether or not they get that, they seem to be very divorced from the process of trying to match those two up. So
Pay attention to your school board's votes.
Finally, in an op-ed, the OU Daily called on Governor Mary Fallon and Democratic candidate Joe Dorman to hold a second gubernatorial debate on the University of Oklahoma campus. Ryan, what do you think about this request?
Well, you know, don't count her out just yet. You know, the governor's changed her mind on so many different issues over the course of the first term of her administration. You know, she could just as easily, you know, be against debating this week and then next week be all for the debate. You know, they just need to poll it. You know, these campaigns really aren't about the candidates. And I think that, you know, the candidates certainly try to make it about them. And they try to minimize their mistakes and minimize their exposure to make those mistakes going off script. Anytime you're communicating with voters outside the four corners of a direct mail piece, a TV ad, a radio spot, newspaper spot, whatever, you know, people still advertise in newspapers. But all of those things that are combined as part of the campaign, they can make a mistake. And if you're the incumbent, if you've got what you assume is a lead, of course you don't want to do that. But at the end of the day, the voters deserve to have another stab at hearing the candidates explain their position.
Is there any possibility of a debate?
I don't think so. No. But I think the bigger issue is these folks have been out on the campaign trail now for months. And for any group, whether it's a university, whether it's any group or organization that wants to have a legitimate debate or forum, there have been ample opportunities to make those requests to both of the campaigns. And frankly, I think, you know, what we have is in the instance of the OSU debate, They were proactive. They got out front. They mm-hmm. they got an agreement early. Whether OU, that's right. And so you can't come to the dance late and expect to expect to get a good result. So I think we're in a situation where the argument that this is somehow going to increase voter participation, it's going to be better to get younger voters involved. That's a weak argument when even on the OSU campus for that particular debate that took place, I think, on October 2nd, there were, it was not a packed house. So I think there are opportunities to get the information out, to re-air it, to have it on the Internet and other forms of ways to communicate what was said. It sounds good, but this isn't a presidential campaign, and we're not going to have a long series of debates, I don't think, unless the public really demands it. And there hasn't really been a public outcry. It's been isolated groups that have made requests here and there.
And Eva, I think you'll agree with me. If Joe Dorman pulls this thing off, and he's the next governor of the state of Oklahoma, let's hope that he remembers accepting this debate,
right.
And that 4 years from now, he won't dodge debates as an incumbent.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.